We're on day two of the Senate confirmation hearing of Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett. This time, Judge Barrett faces questions from members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Welcome to Washington Today for Tuesday, October 13th. I'm your host, Nkoyo Iyamba. We're 21 days from the presidential election. President Donald Trump will hold a rally in Pennsylvania as his Democratic challenger Joe Biden campaigns in Florida. President Trump and Joe Biden concentrated Tuesday on battleground states. Both campaigns see their strategy as critical to clinching the 270 votes needed for an Electoral College victory. The Washington Post reports that former Vice President Joe Biden leads President Donald Trump by 12 percentage points nationally, 54% to 42%. However, Biden's margin is smaller in key states, 8 points in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, 7 points in Michigan, and 3 points in Arizona and Florida. Meanwhile, millions of ballots for the presidential election have already been cast around the country. There are long lines at voting locations in Georgia and Texas, where there's record voter turnout. There are also long lines in Virginia, which officials are blaming on technical errors. More on that story in a few minutes. As early voting began in Texas on Tuesday, voters are also experiencing long lines in San Antonio and outside Houston. The Associated Press reports that some of those long lines are the result of increased voter turnout and others linked to voting machine failures. Also in Texas, a federal panel of appellate judges have upheld an order to limit ballot drop boxes to one per county. Here on Capitol Hill, President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett repeatedly declined to answer questions on Tuesday about her views on abortion and Obamacare, this on the second day of her confirmation hearings. Judge Barrett refused to commit to recuse herself from cases involving disputes over next month's presidential election, but she told senators she will not allow herself, quote, to be used as a pawn to decide the election for the American people, end quote. As a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit for the past 3 years, Judge Barrett has not directly decided cases involving election issues. Tuesday marked Judge Barrett's first time answering questions from senators as a Supreme Court nominee. She will have a second day of questions Wednesday. Thursday's session will consist of an outside panel of experts. Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham has also scheduled a committee vote to send her nomination to the Senate floor on Thursday, though a final vote on Barrett's nomination is slated for October 22nd. Here's Chairman Graham earlier today questioning Judge Barrett on her judicial style.
Justice Scalia, he was an originalist, right?
Yes, he was.
People say that you're a female Scalia. What would you say?
I would say that Justice Scalia was obviously a mentor, and as I said when I accepted the president's nomination, that his philosophy is mine too. You know, he was a very eloquent defender of originalism, and that was also true of textualism, which is the way that I approach statutes and their interpretation. And similarly to what I just said about originalism, for textualism, the judge approaches the text as it was written with the meaning it had at the time and doesn't infuse her own meaning into it. But I want to be careful to say that if I'm confirmed, you would not be getting Justice Scalia, you would be getting Justice Barrett. And that's so because originalists don't always agree, and neither do textualists. Justices Scalia and Thomas disagreed often enough that my friend Judge Amul Thapar teaches a class called Scalia versus Thomas. You know, it's not a mechanical exercise.
Well, I'll wait till the movie comes out.
Judge Barrett earlier today with Committee Chair Lindsey Graham. He also questioned how she would rule on certain topics and how her own personal beliefs could impact decisions.
The Heller case is a case decided by the Supreme Court, which held that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms.
Okay. Now, my friends on the left, some of them have a problem with Heller. They may try to challenge the construct of Heller. If a state or local government passed a law in defiance of Heller, what would happen?
In defiance of Heller?
Or that was challenging the construct of Heller?
That challenged the construct of Heller. If it was brought in a lower court, Heller binds. I mean, lower courts always have to follow Supreme Court precedent. And so that
And if the Supreme Court wanted to revisit Heller, what would they do?
if someone challenged Heller below because a state or local government passed a law contradicting Heller, the Supreme Court would have to take that case once it was appealed all the way up. So the court would have to decide, yes, we want to overrule Heller, and we have enough votes to grant cert and then do so.
So that's the way the process works.
Yes, it would start because there was a law, then there was a lawsuit, then there was an appeal, then the court granted cert, and then the court decided the case.
Is that true no matter what the issue is, whether it's gun, abortion, health care, campaign finance? Does that process hold true for everything?
Yes, you always judges can't just wake up one day and say, I have an agenda, I like guns, I hate guns, I like abortion, I hate abortion, and walk in like a royal queen and impose, you know, their will on the world. You have to wait for cases and controversies, which is the language of the Constitution, to wind their way through the process.
Judge Barrett earlier today. Supreme Court nominees typically avoid answering specific questions about how they would rule in cases that could come before the court. But Judge Barrett's responses hindered Democrats who have zeroed in on health care as their top issue in the Supreme Court fight. In particular, protections for Americans with pre-existing health conditions. Those protections were enshrined in the Affordable Care Act and could be eliminated as a result of a pending case before the court. Ranking Member Dianne Feinstein of California questioned Judge Barrett on her views on the Affordable Care Act, but also attempted to get an answer on where the nominee stands on Roe v. Wade. Here's that exchange.
So, Senator, I do want to be forthright and answer every question so far as I can. I think on that question, I'm going to invoke Justice Kagan's description, which I think is perfectly put. When she was in her confirmation hearing, she said that she was not going to grade precedent or give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And I think in an area where precedent continues to be pressed and litigated, as is true of Casey, it would be particularly, it would actually be wrong and a violation of the canons for me to do that as a sitting judge. So if I express a view on a precedent one way or another, whether I say I love it or I hate it, it signals to litigants that I might tilt one way or another in a pending case.
So on something that is really a major cause with major effect on over half of the population of this country, who are women, after all, it's distressing not to get a straight answer. So let me try again. Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe was wrongly decided?
Senator, I completely understand why you are asking the question, but again, I can't pre-commit or say, yes, I'm going in with some agenda, because I'm not. I don't have any agenda. I have no agenda to try to overrule Casey. I have an agenda to stick to the rule of law and decide cases as they come.
Well, what I'm, as a person, I don't know if you'll answer this one either. Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe can and should be overturned by the Supreme Court?
Well, I think my answer is the same because, you know, that's a case that's litigated. It could, you know, its contours could come up again. In fact, do come up. You know, they came up last term before the court. So I think, you know, what the Casey standard is, and it's a contentious issue, which is, I know, one reason why it would be comforting to you to have an answer. But I can't express views on cases or pre-commit to approaching a case any particular way.
Well, that makes it difficult for me, and I think for other women also on this committee, because this is a very important case, and it affects a lot of people, millions and millions of women, and you could be a very important vote. And I had hoped you would say, as a person, you've got a lovely family, you understand all the implications of family life, you should be very proud of that. I'm proud of you for that. But my position is a little different. You're going on the biggest court of this land with a problem out there that all women see one way or another in their life. And not all, but yeah, certainly married women do, and others too. And so the question comes, what happens? And will this justice support a law that has substantial precedent now, would you commit yourself on whether you would or would not?
Senator, what I will commit is that I will obey all the rules of stare decisis, that if a question comes up before me about whether Casey or any other case should be overruled, that I will follow the law of stare decisis, applying it as the court has articulated it, applying all the factors, reliance, workability, being undermined by later facts and law, just all the standard factors. And I promise to do that for any issue that comes up, abortion or anything else. I'll follow the law.
Senator Dianne Feinstein earlier today with Judge Barrett. Some members of the Judiciary Committee came armed with detailed questions for Judge Barrett, but Republican Senator Mike Lee used the bulk of his 30-minute time slot to expound on his personal views about law and government. He lectured the room about the separation of powers and the debate over abortion in the United States. He invoked Alexander Hamilton and the Federalist Papers. He accused Democrats of, quote, fear-mongering about health care.
I want to speak next about the Affordable Care Act. We've seen posters going up over and over and over again. We've seen them yesterday. We've seen them today. We've seen a lot of compelling stories about people whose lives have been marked by difficult things that they've endured. They've involved touching and heartwarming stories. I continue to doubt the relevance of things like that here, especially insofar as they're being used to suggest that your confirmation to the Supreme Court of the United States has anything to do with their health care. Tell me why you think that any individual American's health care status is or is not tied to your confirmation to the Supreme Court of the United States.
It is not tied to my nomination to the Supreme Court of the United States. I have said repeatedly under oath that I had no conversations with anyone in the White House about that case. And I'm not sure, to the extent there's a suggestion that I have an agenda that I want to strike down people's protection for pre-existing conditions, that's just not true. I've never taken that position. And as I've also said repeatedly, any policy preferences that I have don't matter anyway. They're irrelevant. So making that law, coming out with the contours of the ACA, that's your job.
That was Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, earlier today. During his time, Senator Lee directly addressed Judge Barrett about a dozen times, sometimes asking her to validate points he had just made. Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, asked Judge Amy Coney Barrett whether she considered the ruling in Roe v. Wade to be a super precedent. The nominee defines the terms, as she used it, quote, to define cases that are so well settled that no political actors and no people seriously push for their overruling, end quote. Here's that exchange.
This hearing is not normal. It is a sham. It is a rush to put in a justice. The last time that we had a vacancy so close to an election was when Abraham Lincoln was president, and he made the wise decision to wait until after the election. The last time we lost a justice so close to an election. That's what he did. Today, we are 21 days from the election. People are voting. Millions of people have already cast their ballots. And I go to the words of Senator McConnell. The last time we had a situation in election year, he said, the American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court justice. Therefore, this vacancy should not be filled until we have a new president. That set the precedent that so many of you have embraced, or at least you did a few years ago, and that is that in an election year, the people choose the president, and then the president nominates the justice. So why is this happening? Well, that's a good question. This guy, our president, he is the one that decided to plop a Supreme Court nomination in the middle of an election, when people's health care is on the line, with a case before the court on November 10th. So let's see what he said about the Supreme Court. Well, one of President Trump's campaign promises in 2015 was that his judicial appointment will do the right thing on Obamacare. You can see it right here. And in fact, Judge, just one day after you were nominated, this is like a few weeks ago, he said also on Twitter that it would be a big win if the Supreme Court strikes down the health law. So, Judge, my first question, do you think we should take the president at his word when he says his nominee will do the right thing and overturn the Affordable Care Act?
Senator Klobuchar, I can't really speak to what the president has said on Twitter. He hasn't said any of that to me. And what I can tell you, as I have told your colleagues earlier today, is that no one has elicited from me any commitment in a case or even brought up a commitment in the case. I'm 100% committed to judicial independence from political pressure. So whatever people's, you know, party platforms may be or campaign promises may be, the reason why judges have life tenure is to insulate them from those pressures. So I take my oath seriously to follow the law, and, you know, I have not pre-committed, nor would I pre-commit to decide a case any particular way.
Okay. And I think this life tenure, this idea that you have, just for everyone out there, a job for life, makes this even more important for us to consider where you might be. And I know you have not said how you would rule on this case that's coming up right after the election, where the president had said it would be a big win if the Supreme Court strikes down the law. But you have directly criticized Justice Roberts in an article in my own state in one of the Minnesota Law School journals. It was in 2017. It was the same year you became a judge. And when Roberts writes the opinion to uphold the Affordable Care Act, you said he, quote, pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute. Is that correct?
Senator Klobuchar, I just want to clarify, is this the constitutional commentary publication that you and I discussed?
Yes, it is. It is, but it's still a University of Minnesota law. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure because I hadn't published in the Minnesota law review.
Again, did you ask that question? Did you say that he pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute?
One thing I want to clarify is you said that I criticized, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, and I don't attack people, just ideas. So that was just designed to make a comment about his reasoning in that case, which as I've said before, is consistent with the way the majority opinion characterized it as the less plausible reading of the statute.
That was Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, earlier today, questioning Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett. You can find the entire hearing on our website at cspan.org. You're listening to Washington Today. On this morning's Washington Journal program on C-SPAN television, Kaiser Health News Washington correspondent Julie Rovner discussed what's at stake for the Affordable Care Act when it goes before the Supreme Court the second week of November.
That's right. I think the Democrats did not plan it this way, but it's certainly at least playing into their campaign theme for this year. Remember, in 2018, they ran on the Republicans' efforts to undo the Affordable Care Act, and the Democrats did very well in 2018. Now we have this court case that was actually filed in early 2018, partly with the intent to gin up Republican votes. This was a number of Republican attorneys general from about 20 states who charged that because the 2017 tax bill passed by the Republicans in Congress eliminated the penalty for not having insurance, the most unpopular piece of the Affordable Care Act that said if you don't have insurance, you have to pay a tax penalty. They zeroed that out for complicated procedural reasons. They couldn't make it go away, but they just set the penalty to zero. So now what the law says is you either have to have health insurance or you have to pay a penalty of $0. And the Republican attorneys general argued that because in 2012, when the Supreme Court upheld the law, they did it based on Congress's use of the taxing power. If there was no tax anymore, and there is no tax anymore, therefore the rest of the law is unconstitutional and must fall. And a federal district court judge in Texas agreed with them in December of 2018. And then an appeals court sort of agreed with that, but they sent the case back to the lower court judge and say, really, does the whole law have to go away without the tax, or maybe just the things that are connected directly to that tax penalty? And rather than wait another year or so for the lower court judge to make his decision and the appeals court to make yet another decision, Democratic attorneys general who are defending the law appealed to the Supreme Court. Now, they wanted this case settled this past spring. This was back in the winter that they appealed to the Supreme Court. They hoped the court would take it up and resolve it this past June. Instead, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, but they agreed to hear it in the term that started just a couple of weeks ago. And the date that they ended up setting for the argument is November 10th, a week after the election.
So when the court takes this up and their eventual ruling, could they, a lot of people written that they are likely not to declare it unconstitutional, but they could mortally wound it by invalidating the mandate, correct?
Well, they could do a couple of things. They could do what the Trump administration was first arguing, which is saying that the mandate is no longer constitutional since it doesn't have a tax penalty attached to it. But the things that are immediately connected to that, and those include the very popular things like requiring insurers to sell to people with pre-existing conditions and not charging them more. It's possible that that chunk of the law might have to go. That would be rather unpopular. It is possible that they would say, no, the whole law has to fall, even though it's an enormous law and most of it is completely unconnected to the penalty for having insurance. Or they could say what many academics on both sides of the Affordable Care Act think, which is that this is not a very strong lawsuit and they could make the entire thing go away, which was frankly what the Democratic attorneys general had in mind when they asked the Supreme Court to weigh in early on this case. At that point, it was four liberals and Chief Justice Roberts who had twice voted to uphold the Affordable Care Act. So there was every sort of confidence that the four liberals and Chief Justice would make five, and it didn't matter what the other four conservatives wanted to do. If Judge Barrett becomes Justice Barrett and is on the court and hears the case, then it won't matter, or it wouldn't necessarily have to matter, what the Chief Justice does, because there will only be three liberals left and the five conservatives can determine what happens to the law.
Julie Rovner, you wrote a piece, and it's at khn.org if you want to read Julie Rovner's writing, khn.org. Just after Justice Ginsburg died, the headline was, "Without Ginsburg, Judicial Threats to the ACA and Reproductive Rights Heighten." Now, you wrote this piece, I believe, before the announcement of the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett. She's been on the bench, the Seventh Circuit, 3 years. That, and what else do we know about her rulings and her decisions on women's health care, on the Affordable Care Act, on reproductive rights?
Well, we know that she's been something of an anti-abortion activist, and that's likely to come up in the questioning today and tomorrow, because, you know, even more than having written that she doesn't, she does not believe in abortion and she does not believe that Roe v. Wade was decided correctly, she has been part of advocacy efforts, which is unusual for someone being considered to be a justice. On healthcare, she has written that she thought that Chief Justice Roberts stretched the reasoning too far in the original 2012 case that upheld the Affordable Care Act. So we don't know, obviously we don't know how she's going to rule, and it is pretty safe to say that she's not going to say how she would rule, because senators always ask prospective justices and they do not answer, because that's sort of part of how this is done. But there is certainly reason, if you are supportive of women's reproductive rights and you are supportive of the Affordable Care Act, there is reason for concern. The other thing, of course, the converse we know, which is that the president promised when he was running for the first time in 2016 that he would only appoint justices who were committed to overturning Roe v. Wade. So one would assume that the president would not have appointed somebody that he was not confident would be an anti-abortion vote.
Kaiser Health News Washington correspondent Julie Rovner. Two of the men accused of plotting to kidnap Michigan's governor took part in discussions earlier this year with members of self-styled militia groups about potentially abducting Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, an FBI agent testified Tuesday. Special Agent Richard Trask testified that two of the defendants, Adam Fox and Barry Croft, attended a meeting in June in Dublin, Ohio, with members of militias from four or five states. Quote, "At that meeting, They discussed possible targets, taking a sitting governor, specifically issues with the governors of Michigan and Virginia based on their lockdown orders, end quote. That's according to Trask's testimony. Both Virginia and Michigan have been hotspots for protests over government shutdowns and other restrictions meant to slow the coronavirus. One large demonstration in Richmond earlier this year followed President Trump's tweet to, quote, liberate Virginia. Earlier today, Governor Northam held a press conference to discuss the state's COVID-19 response, but also answered questions about the alleged kidnapping.
And what specific examples do you see of the president encouraging violence against you?
Let me answer the second part of your question. You know, back in, I believe it was April, the months tend to run together. The CDC offered guidelines on how to combat the spread of COVID-19, and in those outlines were wearing facial masks, social distancing, and hand washing, things that we had already been advocating for. And 2 days later, the president said to liberate Virginia. So that's an example of mixed messages coming out of Washington, which we've been seeing since the beginning of this pandemic. But words have meaning to people, and so when our leaders make statements like this, and that's just one example of many. I know you all are well aware of other things that have been said. But again, when we're listening to the people, which is what I've done as governor, I work with our legislature. They responded to the previous election as well. And I realize I've been in this long enough that not everything we do is agreeable to all Virginians. But when language is used such as to liberate Virginia, people, they find meaning in those words, and thus these things happen, and that's regrettable.
Virginia Governor Ralph Northam earlier today. Campaign 2020 on C-SPAN Radio. Today is the last day to register to vote in Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia. But that proved to be a major headache for Virginians. A severed fiber optic cable shut down Virginia's online voter registration system Tuesday, the last day to register before the November general election. The Virginia Department of Elections said in a statement on Twitter that a fiber cut was affecting connectivity for multiple agencies, including the Citizen Portal and the Registrar's offices, and technicians were working to repair the problem. Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax tweeted the following, quote, I'm officially calling for Virginia's registration deadline to be extended beyond today due to the service outages impacting voters' ability to register statewide. We will work with the administration to resolve this issue and ensure all voters have access to hashtag vote. Vice President Mike Pence resumed his tour of Wisconsin Tuesday with some tough words on law and order during a campaign rally at Weldon Manufacturing. Over the last 2 years, Vice President Pence has made frequent appearances across the state, from Marinette to La Crosse. Here are his remarks.
The men and women who serve in law enforcement are some of the best people in this country, and they deserve the respect of every American every single day. Now, the President and I will always support the right of Americans to peaceful protest. It's enshrined in the Constitution. But rioting and looting is not peaceful protest. Burning businesses is not free speech. Violence against innocent civilians, the destruction of property, or violence against law enforcement will not be tolerated, and those who do these things will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Now, for months, all Joe Biden talked about was peaceful protesters. Remember? All summer long, as the American people watch businesses and communities literally burn. We saw cities in Wisconsin like Kenosha and Milwaukee beset by violence and destruction. The truth of the matter is, though, Joe Biden would double down on the policies that have led to violence in America's cities. I mean, when you withdraw support for those who protect and serve, you only embolden those who would do harm to our families and our communities. I mean, it's no surprise Milwaukee has literally seen 110% increase in homicides this year.
That was Vice President Mike Pence earlier today in Wisconsin. Democratic nominee Joe Biden is in Florida today, where this afternoon he was campaigning at the Pembroke Pines Senior Center. While in Florida today, Biden is scheduled to address his, quote, vision for older Americans and encourage seniors to make a plan to vote. Here's the Democratic nominee earlier today.
At the Trump campaign, which is not unusual because I've had a piece of it, Trump campaign has deliberately lied. They have put Dr. Fauci in their ad, asserting that Fauci was talking about Trump when he said, couldn't have done any more. But Fauci's a man of integrity. After that ad came out saying, he said, I did not give permission to use that quote, and I wasn't referring to the president. Even when, after Fauci said that, he didn't say that about the president. The Trump ad campaign said they were going to continue to use the ad, knowing it was a lie. Can any of you ever remember anything like that in a presidential campaign with a mainstream candidate? And as a consequence, to months of lying, misleading, and irresponsible action on the part of Donald Trump, how many empty chairs are around the dining room table tonight because of his negligence? How many people's hearts are broken? How many people have trouble going to sleep at night because they can't just reach over and touch? They can't hear their son or daughter's voice on the phone. While he throws super spreader parties at the White House, where Republicans hug each other without concern of the consequences. How many of you have been unable to hug your grandkids in the last 7 months? I got six of them. Two of them, my deceased son's boys, they live not, children, a boy and a girl, live not far from me. They can walk through the woods. The only way I can see them, I stand on the back porch, and they stand down, and I bribe them with Haagen-Dazs bars. But every single day I contact them. But I can't hug them. I can't embrace them.
Democratic nominee Joe Biden earlier today in Florida. And Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney calls on American leaders to, quote, lower the heat and says the world is watching in, quote, abject horror. In a tweet Tuesday morning, Senator Romney wrote in part, quote, the president calls the Democratic vice presidential candidate a monster. He repeatedly labels the Speaker of the House crazy. He calls for the Justice Department to put the prior president in jail. He attacks the governor of Michigan on the very day a plot is discovered to kidnap her. Then Senator Romney wrote this about Democrats. Quote, Democrats launch blistering attacks of their own, though their presidential nominee refuses to stoop as low as others. Pelosi tears up the president's speech on national television. Keith Olbermann calls the president a terrorist. Media on the left and right amplify all of it. Quote, the world is watching America with abject horror. More consequentially, our children are watching. Then Senator Romney called on everyone to, quote, lower the heat, leaders from the top and leaders of all stripes. If you've missed any part of this episode, you can find it on the free C-SPAN Radio app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for joining us today on Washington Today. We hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.